When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Moments That Rock, a cornucopia of all things music. We have music industry insiders and artists, producers, engineers, and we've got one of those today. His name's Andy Jackson. He's worked with everybody. He's been producing for decades. I'll be polite, he'll tell you how many years when we get on with it. But as usual, we let the guest introduce themselves.
Hi there, I'm Andy Jackson. I've been a recording engineer and producer for 40-something years now, mostly known for my work with Pink Floyd, which I've done since 1981, the Wall movie, and done most things since then. I also make my own music, which is much more my passion these days and what I spend most of my time doing.
I mean, have you always been a musician then? You just went the other route to kind of not being an artist but being behind-the-scenes producer such?
My dad, had, again, not professionally, was a jazz musician, and he taught me to play guitar, and I always loved music. And when I was finishing up at school and due to go to university to do material sciences, and I thought, oh my God, I don't think I can fancy this, and I couldn't think what to do, and a friend of mine that I played music with said, why don't you get a job in a studio? And got a job in a U, and the rest is history. Really, just learn on the job, and I've always, always been a mediocre musician as well, and through one of the other guys who worked in a studio where I was, he went and did the Wall album, and I followed him into the organisation. So yeah, I mean, I think I've never known an engineer that isn't a musician in some capacity. I think inevitably, even if you just plonk around on a bit of guitar sort of thing.
Yeah, I suppose the classic example is Tony Visconti, produces Bowie and then he jumps on his records as well.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, and he played bass. Played bass on some of the early stuff as well. Oddly, as someone, I know Tony a bit. Well, I mean, I worked with Tony a long time ago. We did a Caravan album together. He was an interesting bloke. He just sort of exuded niceness and things just happened around him. And it all happened very quickly. I think we did that album in 2 weeks. So, yeah.
I think it's really important, the relationship between the artist and the producer, And I always feel musicians are too close to it because it's their own music, So who are you to say anything about it? But I always feel that, you look at what happened with you too when they went with Eno and Daniel Lanois and everything. Tell me how the association with the Pink Floyd came, because it's not bad to have on your resume, is it?
No. Well, as I say, I mean, James Guthrie, who I had originally worked with when I was he worked for the same studio as me. I was sort of largely his assistant, and he'd done the Wall album, and then that morphed into doing the Wall film, and they simply just needed more people on hand. So he drafted me in. It was a sort of nice, convenient point for me to leave being employed and go freelance. And he drafted me in initially just to help with the engineering logistics on the Wall, because we were doing it in a way that hadn't been done before, of taking music recording equipment into the film dubbing scenario. All their stuff was on this weird sprocketed tape, so it looked half like film, but it was magnetic tape, which kept everything running in sync, but sounded terrible. So we had to devise a way to use our equipment there, and I was brought in to help with that initially. But that the Wall movie then just morphed immediately into what was the final cut album. They believed they were contractually obliged, Floyd believed they were contractually obliged to do a soundtrack album, which would mean the album of the film of the album, which didn't make any sense at all. So the idea was to do sort of more Wall songs, songs that could have been on the Wall but weren't on the Wall. And we were halfway through that album and it was realised that we didn't have to do it. We didn't have to do a contractual application album at all. But then we were halfway through an album, so we just carried on and finished it. And then that morphed straight into Roger Waters' solo album, and I did David's solo album in the middle, and it just stayed. And as very often is the case, it ends up being a lifetime, and it's still ongoing in theory.
So how was that in the latter stages? Because you must have been kind of the middle of where the kind of disruption within the band was coming on, eh?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of, I mean, inevitably one ends up in one camp or the other, and basically I ended up in David's camp. Not because that was my choice, just because that's the way it panned out. And, you know, Roger has moved and lives in New York now, last time I heard he lived in New York. So I just became David's guy, really, which meant doing both Floyd's stuff and his solo stuff and bits and pieces of other stuff, because he occasionally produced stuff and things like that as well. So, and then in more recent times, there's been endless sort of rejigging back catalogue stuff to do, which has kept me very, very busy, really. It gets a bit boring, that, in some ways, you know, remixing old albums and things like that. It's nice in some ways because they let you get on with it, really. So basically I would do stuff and then present it and make any alterations that were requested. But in the end, it gets a bit boring. But so it just it turned into a lifetime. I mean, there were a few other bits and pieces on the way, but you know, 90 or 95% of what I've done has been Floyd related.
Great. How did you find working with kind of the record industry? Because you come from the creative side, and they're looking for some way to sell extra copies of product.
Yeah, well, I'm somewhat insulated from that, really. Being a studio guy and working with them as well, because they're very insulated from it. Nobody sticks their nose in, really. I mean, and certainly in my time working in a commercial studio, you'd be very aware of people from the record company turning up at the studio or having a great deal of influence in things. But once you get to a band with enough selling power like Floyd, everyone leaves them alone, really. So I just never had to deal with that stuff at all. Which I must admit is a blessing.
Yeah. When did Richard Wright pass?
Oh God! Now you're asking for a date. God, it's got to be. I honestly can't remember how long ago it was. It was ages ago, wasn't it? So, we did Endless River. So it's well over 10 years. Well over 10 years ago. I mean, he'd obviously been ill for some time, so it was not entirely unexpected.
He was always
a smoker. So,
I mean, I know you chose the David Gilmour route, but it's not for me to say. But I will say, but I would have assumed from everything you read around and about that it was kind of the right choice.
First of all, that ended up as what Pink Floyd was, really, rather than Roger's side, which was not Pink Floyd. I mean, you know, and there's an awful lot of history about that one, but that's the way it certainly ended up. Roger's not easy. Mm. Roger's not an easy person. I did Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking, a solo album with him, which was about a year in the studio together, and that was tough. And, in fact, he asked me to do the next one, which was Radio Chaos. And I just, despite the fact that obviously it would be a big bunch of work, I said no, because it's just too hard.
I think that's a credit to yourself, though, because I think, you know, at the end of the game, it is the entertainment industry, and if you're not kind of 100%, you know, behind what you're doing, then it's arguably it might not bring the best out in you anyway.
But I mean, a technical role, really. I mean, it's a creative technical role, but you know, I'm there to do other people's bidding. I mean, that's always the thing about being an engineer, and I mean, to a lesser extent, being a producer. There's a certain degree of negotiation in that, depending on what the relationship is. But we are there to service them, really. You know, I always say it's their name on the front cover, not mine. That's what matters, is what they want.
Yeah, I agree, and I understand where you're coming from. With something as big and powerful as a machine as the Pink Floyd, at the end of the day, they can get right to the decision makers at the record company and everything. I don't know, I'm not an artist, but if I was an artist, I would like an input from... I mean, the way things have changed nowadays, Andy, is like, I could make a record. I can't sing and I can't play, but I could make a record. Well, there's kind of something wrong with that. But I think, like, from the producer and in the engineer and everything, is like, have you thought of doing it this way? Because musicians tend to have a habit of liking the last thing they ever wrote anyway. So if you kind of find other tracks or different ways to do stuff, and you're prepared to listen to what somebody who is just hearing it as it is and seeing what they can do with it, if it was me, I'd listen.
Yeah, there's a guy I worked with quite a bit when I was in the early days, called Richard Burgess, who produced a whole bunch of successful pop stuff. I mean, we did Spend Our Ballet together. And he ended up writing a book about what is the role of the record producer. And he identified a bunch of different ones that have different roles. And I can't remember it in full detail. But for example, you would get the Svengali, someone like, you know, Pete Waterman or someone like that, who it was their record and they just slotted in an artist on top of it. And then at the other end of the scale, you'd get what Richard referred to as loyal servant, which would be someone like me or Hugh Padgham with Phil Collins and things. You're essentially someone who is there to facilitate the artist and knows them very well and knows just what they want and just what they like and can do it very well. So there's all sorts of different possible relationships between an artist and a producer, depending what's needed, and you know, hopefully one gets a good match between what is needed and what the person can provide. Of course, famously, sometimes not, and you get real clashes between people, and producers get changed for that reason, because you know, maybe the producer is trying to pursue a particular vision and the artist doesn't want that vision. So it's not a fixed relationship at all. It's not like something like a film director, where essentially they've got all the power. It's a much more nuanced role, and it's going to vary every time. It's going to be different. I mean, hopefully, yeah, you can give the artist what they need, and if they need help and advice and guidance, then you're there to give that. I think one of the reasons I've ended up working with David so much is that for a lot of people, when you get someone that's as successful and talented as he is, a lot of people, whatever he plays, they'll say, yeah, that's great, fantastic, Dave, you know, kind of thing. I don't. I'll say, no, do it again. That's not good. I know you can do better, because I do know you can do better. And he actually wants someone to say that to him, and not many people will, because they're overawed by him. So, you know, but we've known each other for an awfully long time, so...
Well, that's the essence of a great relationship, because, you know, I mean, you know, you've got to be prepared to hear what somebody is, you know, honestly going to tell you. You're not going to tell him to be controversial or anything, and you didn't tell him anything about the Comfortably Numb solo, did you?
That was before my time. That one.
Let me have a go at that.
Yeah, no, but, well, I mean, actually, although that wasn't me, but very often things like guitar solos or lead vocals are made by, you perform it a bunch of times and then piece it together out of bits. And James Guthrie put that one together. I mean, David played it, but it wasn't all in one go. So others, you know, somebody else did have an input into that one, which was, you know, James, who was working on that album as the engineer. So you do. It's the way it works, you know.
You're listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides, and today's guest is Andy Jackson, who spent many years working with the Pink Floyd and the associated members' solo projects, i.e. David Gilmour and Roger Waters. We're going to be back in a minute where Andy will tell you about his little solo exploits himself and his own music. We'll be back right after this.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
I remember seeing Roger Waters' Wall tour, also like the building of the wall, and then the guitarist at the top with a white spotlight on him, playing Comfortably Numb, not get David Gilmour, obviously, but note for note. And now you tell me that you have your own, is it a solo project or a band project?
I mean, I did a few a couple of years ago and then sort of left it, and I've come back to it recently. I did an album last year, an instrumental album, and now I've done... just got another one coming out. It's just been put back. It's late March now coming out. And this one is a bunch of songs, but I didn't want to sing again. I sang on a couple of albums and kind of didn't like the process, and I'm not comfortable with my own voice. So
you sound like somebody...
I didn't want to do that.
Do you remember people used to hate the sound of their own voice on answer phones? Oh, I don't like listening to myself.
Yeah, well, it's much the same. Yeah, much the same, to be honest, except amplified. But this one came about by chance. This was about a year or so ago. I came across a synthetic singing program. So AI is slightly overblowing it, but it works like a virtual musical instrument in the same way that anybody who does home recording knows perfectly. You know, you can get, if you want a piano, you don't actually need a piano now. You just have a synthetic one that sounds just like a piano that you run on the computer. And this was the same, except it was a voice. And this is, people have been developing these for a while, but I came across one and I thought, this is incredibly good. It's 95% convincing. And when I listened to it, I thought, well, you can tell little bits and pieces that don't seem quite real. And I thought it would be really interesting to say, well, that's not a bug, it's a feature. And you don't pretend that it's a human. You pretend, you know, you say it's an AI. And right at the same sort of time was when ChatGPT came out, and there was all this stuff being generated where journalists and things had sort of managed to sort of almost break ChatGPT and get it to say things that it shouldn't say. And you got the, you know, it was declaring that it was in love with people and things like that, and all this sort of, and it was just these two things came together. And I thought, there's an album here about an AI singing about being an AI and addressing mm-hmm. the, you know, whoever they're singing to and falling in love with them and all this kind of thing. And that's what the album is. In fact, once I got into it, the voice was better than I thought. And if you do it with care and skill, you really can't tell it's not a human being. And in the end, I was deliberately making messed up bits so that you got the clue it was an AI, you know, that it was glitching and things like that. So I got into exploring the whole, I mean, it's not exactly the totally original idea, the idea of, you know, is the AI actually thinking? I mean, this is what people are talking about now, even about ChatGPT. Is it aware? Is it aware of what it's saying? Is it a thing? Is it? But then it's just, it's been trained on everything we say. So it's repeating those things back to us. And the idea of like, how could we possibly tell if it was conscious or not? Because it's going to mimic being conscious perfectly. And so you get all of those kind of ideas brought into it. And as a little bit of fun, I have not made it completely obvious on the album that it's not a human being. I've credited it as if it were a human being. And there's a picture of the singer on there, except it's just a picture that was made by Dali. It's not a real person. So there's a not a real person singing with a picture of them that's not a real person. And you've got layers and layers and layers of this kind of what's real and what's not real. And it became very amusing to me to do that. And I am really pleased with it. I think it's come out great. Well, and in fact, I now just have carried on. I mean, I never stop now. As soon as I finished that album, I started writing more songs, and I just used the singers. Well, I've got more than one singer now, synthetic singer, and I just use them as if they're singers, and I don't even go down the thing of making it sound artificial. I just pretend it's real. And it's very odd because it's a female voice, but in my mind, that's me because I make it sing. And so that's my voice in a way.
I wonder if there's any kind of legal issues there. Do you get AI trying to sue you for kind of, you know,
no.
Maybe you give them a co-producer credit.
No, there's the company that make it, who are Japanese, make it very clear about what you may and may not do. And the only thing you may not do is claim it to be somebody that it isn't. So you don't even have to credit it, but you can't say, oh, that's somebody else. If you credit it, you have to credit it as what it is. But as it's called Natalie, I just credit it as Natalie.
Yeah.
And that's a person then.
I think it's great though, because it generates like the curiosity within, you know, you want to see how things, a lot of people are frightened by AI, but they're not going to get kind of rid of it. I mean, when you think of it, if you go back all those years, I mean, production and stuff and things and musicianship and stuff, there's a lot of experimentation. I mean, what about Peter Frampton all those years ago with vocoders and things like that?
No, absolutely. Yeah, quite so. I mean, and at what point, you know, it's been an incremental process. I mean, you know, originally we couldn't even record stuff. And then even the act of recording something, it's just like, well, that's not actually being played now. You've moved it in time. You know, somebody played it originally, but then it's been recorded and played at a different time. And so that, you know, that makes it different. And then you start to get electric instruments. So, you know, you get an electric organ. What is that? You know, the sounds on that are produced without actually anything the way that sound is normally produced by things vibrating. And then, you know, and so on and so on in increments and synthesizers and more increments. And it's just a natural progression. I mean, nobody thinks anything at all about the fact that 95% of the records you hear, the drums aren't drums. That's a synthetic drum kit, and the piano isn't a piano. That's synthetic, and the strings aren't an orchestra. That's synthetic, and it's just like, it's an arbitrary line to say the voice has to be a human being. It's like, why does it have to be a human being?
Yeah.
It doesn't.
For instance, if David Bowie was still around, he'd be embracing it because he was always the change agent.
Absolutely.
He was always looking for different things. I mean, I remember like when I was back in the day when I was working with Steve Winwood. I mean, this is a guy who's a genius keyboard player, but he wasn't overwhelmed by synthesizers and things like that. He embraced new technology and he was very curious as to how things work. And yet you think the name Winwood and you just think of that Hammond organ sound, don't you?
But then, you know, Valerie or something like that, you know, he was completely embracing what was new. Bowie is a huge inspiration for me. I mean, I do like a lot of his music, but it's more the way he approached things, being able to say effectively, well, I mean, to put it very much in his terms, that he would put on a mask and today I am that person. I am not me. I'm a different person. And the same with Brian Eno, of saying, looking at what the process is of making a record. And, you know, if you change your process, then you will make something different, even something as simple as try work standing up or, you know, pretend you're in a heavy metal band or something like that. Eno came from visual arts So he and his tutor made a fantastic set of cards called Oblique Strategies, which I use all the time, which just throws you a curveball. So it would say something weird that you have to interpret. Go outside, shut the door. And it's like, what does that mean? You know, and it's just like, it's down to you to interpret. And it just make you think about things in a different way. On all the stuff I'm doing now, on each album, there tends to be a bit of a sort of, I decide on some set of boundaries or set of rules or set of guidance that applies to this project. It puts the blank sheet of paper in a frame so that you've got something to work from. So on the newer stuff, the stuff beyond the AI album, I'm trying to do it with as fewer elements as possible. That's my rule for this one. So can I do it with two instruments or three instruments rather than loads, you know, which forces then to get value out of each bit you do. So you can't just sort of have a part that just plays along with something. It has to do something important because you've got so few things. So it's really interesting, the process of thinking about the way you do things. It adds a whole other element to the creative process. And it's something that I find a great deal of value out of.
Once you lose your curiosity, you lose the thing that's got you there, you know, because obviously you have the talent to work with the stature of the artist that you work for, because, you know, they're risking their career with you if you're shitting at your job. But the fact of the matter is, if you talk about Bowie being a huge influence, you've just endorsed it by what you've said. He was constantly challenging himself. That's what kept him going through all those years. I mean, who would break up Ziggy Stardust when you'd waited 10 years for success, except David Bowie to move on to the next thing? And I heard him say in an interview that, don't make records for other people. Make them for yourself, you know, because that way, and Springsteen's the same. If it's time to make an acoustic record that won't sell, I'm going to do this because I have to release what is inside me in order to go and make the next great record. And I love that about artists, the ones that think differently. I mean, if you look at Eno, I was working with you two at the time, and Chris Blackwell wasn't in favour of them working with Eno and Lenoir, and he'd signed Eno, and he didn't think they were the right fit.
Yeah.
And Steve Lillywhite done a pretty good job, you know, but it was more of a drum sound with two back in the early days. But what a great move, and the rest is history. But if they hadn't have taken that chance, it's like that fearless creative nature within artists, producers. Let's try this. Let's try that.
Yeah, I mean, and I remember reading about that at the time and with Eno and him saying, when they approached him, he thought, well, why do you want me? And they were sort of like, no, we really do want you to do this. And he thought, okay, well, I'll meet with them. And he said, I deliberately made sure I didn't listen to any of their albums before I went.
Love it.
Because the idea of, like, he didn't want a preconception, them to rethink their assumptions, really. I suppose that's the point. It's just, you're just going to slot into a groove, a rut, and do the same things you've done before. And you can do that for a while, but then you'll exhaust that thread, and then you've got nothing.
Is there any people that you wished you'd have worked with?
Well, funnily, you mentioned you too, actually. They did ask me. I mean, they asked me to go out on the road with them, but I didn't. I just got back from doing a Floyd tour, and I really didn't fancy going out on the road for another 18 months. So I actually turned down you too. In some ways, every bit of music I ever like, I would have liked to have been involved in. But on the other hand, I can't exactly look back at my career with a great deal of regret. I mean, I think it's been fantastic. Fortunately, I actually really like Floyd music. So, you know, it's not as if I ended up working with someone where I didn't like music. And I've got to do some fantastic things, you know, just things on a scale that most people would never get to do. We did the first surround simulcast ever, and you know, all sorts of weird technical achievements and things like that. I learned quite early on about getting over-invested in other people's records, because all of that stuff takes a long time. It takes a year to do a Floyd album on average. And at the end of it, you kind of have an emotional need for it to be kind of as if you've managed to bottle God somehow, just make something that is just so incredible. And it's not. It's a record, and it's somebody else's record. And the come down can be really bad. I remember the first one of doing Momentary Lapse. It was a real come down for me. You just have to have a certain emotional distance from it. And that's a shame, but it is necessary to be able to survive it. And oddly, it has carried over into my own work. where I'm intensely involved with the stuff while I do it, and then I leave it and leave it alone and finish. It's finished, and I don't look back at it. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the way it is for me. It's the way it needs to be. I think the album that I did that I most enjoyed listening to when it was finished was with a jazz guitarist, an electronic jazz guitarist called David Tallman. We did the whole album in 4 days. It was a four-piece band. It was almost a jam album. They had it was like proper jazz. They had a theme, and they just start playing, and at some point the theme would happen, and they'd do two or three takes which would bear no resemblance whatsoever to each other, and David would pick one, and that was the record. Then I kind of forgot about it, and now when I listen to it, it's not something I worked on. I don't have any recollection of working on it, kind of thing. So I can actually enjoy it as if I were just a listener.
I think that's really good, Andy, the way you kind of, you know, look at where you're up to and what you're doing and you know, new ventures and just keeping yourself, like, stimulated and excited. It's been a pleasure talking to you, sir. Thank you so much for sharing your career and your stories.
Excellent stuff. You've been listening to Andy Jackson on Moments That Rock. A great career. And I love the gratitude that he shows in the fact that he's had a fantastic career. What a time to work that long with the Pink Floyd and on solo ventures. What a story. So that's it for us. Come back next week. If you like what you heard, review, subscribe, and we'll bring you some great stories next week.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.